Welcome
to the 157th episode of Monkeys Fighting Robots. I'm your host, Matt Sardo. You know, you kind of start off with a plan sometimes, and then the plan changes. Our original plan was to interview Roger Riddell, a contributor on Monkeys Fighting Robots that went up to New York Comic Con this past weekend and intro his piece where he interviews Todd McFarlane. But then Roger and me end up having a long conversation about Spider-Man and the history of Spider-Man that is entertaining and interesting and all this other stuff. It's like 42 minutes long. And I was like, wait a second, we can't use this 42 minute segment to introduce a 15 minute segment because I love you guys, but I know you guys aren't going to stick around for the craziness. But some of you will, and some of you will appreciate this the 42 minutes after the Tom McFarlane interview. So what we're doing is we're changing it up. I'm doing this little intro right here, and Roger interviewed Todd McFarlane at New York Comic Con this past weekend, and they talk about Venom, they talk about the Spawn film, and they talk about toys, and I always get goosebumps listening to Todd McFarlane. Like, he is one of my, like, idols that I just really enjoy listening to him talk because he's just so motivated, so positive, and just, like, gung-ho to change the industry. Whatever industry it is, he wants to change it, and that is what, like, gets my blood flowing entrepreneur-wise, and I just really enjoy listening to him talk and his positivity and his it's a positivity, but it's also cutthroat. Like, it's a very sharp knife of positivity where it's like, and you're done. And it's like, but it's amazing. So here is Roger talking to Todd McFarlane, and I believe this is a Saturday morning interview that he did. So enjoy the Saturday morning interview with Todd McFarlane. Roger and I will be back after the interview to kind of reintroduce the interview, but then just keep listening because it goes downhill quickly, but it's pretty awesome. So thanks for listening and enjoy the interview, guys.
All right, I'm here with Todd McFarlane, the co-creator of Venom, creator of Spawn, owner of McFarlane Toys, co-founder of Image Comics. How's the show treating you so far, Todd? How's the overall crazy cardio of this whole event going?
Okay, here's what I found out fairly early in my career, because I've been going to these things now for, you know, since I was a kid, almost for 40 years now, all right? But, and as a pro for over 30 years now. Every convention is good, and here's why. Because if you're a professional, and I've been that for close to 30 years now, is you come to the convention, you sit down, right? Not high impact. And then people come to you. You don't even have to work that hard. They come to you, and they say nice things for hours and hours on end, right? So how is it even possible to have a bad convention, right? So the moment I walk out of the convention, because the conventions are false positives. Everybody says nice. You actually think you're actually doing everything right. And then you walk outside, and then you deal with the real world, and then you go, oh, darn it, nobody cares who you are, right? So every convention's awesome to me, every convention. I'm thankful to meet the fans. And because people who don't like you aren't going to stand in line for an hour to say that, because they've only got a limited amount of time. They go to the people they like, right? So you're basically preaching to the choir. It's good. Conventions are good.
And so one of your most famous creations had a movie come out recently, Venom.
Yeah.
And I saw that you had attended the premiere.
Yeah.
How was that?
On Monday, yeah. It was funny because they have the big premiere on the red carpet, except for the carpet was black, right? It was the black carpet, which I thought was interesting just to start with. Lots of fans were out there lined up, so I went up and down, signed a bunch of their comic books and their posters and stuff. Got to come in, meet some of the actors, had a nice long conversation with Ruben Fleischer, the director, you know, very charming, pleasant man, whose parents I met live in Phoenix, which where they don't live that far from me. I thought it was kind of cool. And then we had to sit down and see the movie. It was, you know, so I'm going, oh, look at that. And my wife, who was with me, said that there's an Easter egg in there. I didn't see it. So if you guys go to a movie, you can look for it, because I missed it. Eddie Brock is going through some computer file of his girlfriend, and he looks at some paperwork, and the law firm, I wasn't reading the top of the paper because I was reading something else, the top of the law firm, the law firm's called McFarlane McElhinney or McElhinney and McFarlane or something. So I go, look at that. They snuck our names in the middle of the movie. So, and then for me, the big thing I was looking for, maybe David was looking for something different because he's a writer. I was just looking for the visual that I had created 30 years ago, which is this big, gnarly, nasty dude in a black costume. And minus the spider on his chest, I saw it. I saw this big, hulking creature on the screen. Because the first go-around, remember when they did it in Spider-Man number 3, the Topher Grace?
Yeah.
The conversion didn't add that much weight to him. And again, I'm just being biased and selfish. That in my brain, I'm going, no. Venom's huge, right? He's way bigger than a normal human being. And the Sony movie, I saw this big hulking figure up on screen a lot.
Yeah, and your other most well-known creation, Spawn, you're working on a movie for him right now. We talked about that last year.
Yeah.
Where are you at with that right now? I know that you've got Jamie Foxx cast as Al Simmons.
Yeah, and then we added Jeremy Renner as Twitch, the detective that's in it. Brought on board not long ago, Greg Nicotero. From Walking Dead fame, you know, he created all those zombies. Actually worked on the first Spawn movie 20 years ago, and both he and I were way younger. And then Greg's also directed more Walking Dead than anybody else. So when I sat with him, which to talk about the costume, and I just had a meeting with him literally 2 hours ago, offsite, that he, because he's a director now, understands some of the stuff that's in my head that might not be written down on paper. You know, I wrote the screenplay, so I might not be using the right word. And when I visualize it to him, he's smart enough to be able to sort of go, oh, yeah, I can do that. And we'll make it in such a way that it'll actually shoot good on camera and it'll show good on camera. And when I was meeting with him, he actually did some 3D outputs of some of the stuff that we've designed, and he painted it. So today, literally today, I saw the Spawn that I want in the movie. I saw it today physically. I went, wow! And he met and exceeded all my expectations. I go, ding, 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 ding. That's what we've been talking about. That's what we've been designing. And now to just be able to hold it in my hand, I go, wow. So now I need to take that into Hollywood because they're having a little bit of trouble trying to get their head wrapped around what I'm trying to do. I need to tweak this script, I guess, a little bit more to fine-tune it a bit for him and then just get him out of that superhero mode. But, if I bring in now these printouts and my animatics and my imagery and I do my song and dance, then maybe I can get them into a framework that when they read the script will make sense to them, which is basically... It's just a creepy movie, right? I mean, you can do The Nun and you can do Halloween, you can do Spawn, right? So, but if you're thinking of the Avengers, then what I'm trying to do falls completely apart. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and I've been rewatching the animated series from HBO recently and rereading some of the early Spawn books. So how does the overall tone that you're going for kind of compare to those?
Yeah, so the original movie 20 years ago was a PG-13 movie. Then we did the R-rated HBO stuff that had every warning on it, if you remember, right? There's only five. We had all five. Over the years... I've had way more response to the HBO of people going, oh, that was way darker and way grittier. So take what we did on HBO and then quadruple it in terms of just the dark sadisticness of it, right? So if you want a serious tone, I don't mean blood and guts and gore. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm just talking about serious, harsh, scary, creepy, insane, messed up stuff, then that's where we're going. And there were, especially in the third season of HBO, I thought we got closer to what we're talking about. I want to go way beyond that, but, you know, we laid some of the blueprint down there.
And when you're writing for a character like that that's darker and grittier in nature, how do you kind of find the right balance so that it doesn't seem like it's maybe like edgy or...
It is edgy. Pretty,
well, yeah, but for the sake of being edgy as opposed to just like having a natural feel to it. You know what I mean?
I think the existence of my book not being a superhero book in the truest sense for 25 years, and especially currently, if you go buy this Spawn comic book now, it's way closer to what I'm going to present in the movie than obviously the first couple issues that came out 25 years ago. So there's been an evolution in him. I mean, obviously, when I left Marvel and we started Image Comic Books and Spawn was my first book, yeah, there's this heavy reliance on superhero tropes and the rule of a superhero comic book. But that was 25 years ago, and I've since evolved it. And so it's gotten to be more of a creepy horror book. Yeah. And will continue to be so.
Yeah, because like what I was getting at was like, how do you avoid, I guess, maybe things coming off as cliche if you try to... I guess there's like a forced edginess to some things that you know, some writers try to avoid that, if you get what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, here's what I would say. Let's just get a way that you can do super creepy superhero first before we worry about the cliches of that, right? Yeah. I've got to just get people to accept that you can even get away and do super creepy superhero stuff, right? So, I you know, because there's either just superheroes or there's creepy, and there hasn't been sort of like the hybrid. Now, maybe it's because nobody wants it, and maybe it's because there's no need for it, and I'm just a man on an island right now. But when I give talks, and I'm going to meet some people, and I did a couple yesterday, I'm going to give another one tomorrow, I think there's a hunger among adults, not 8-year-old kids, amongst adults, and I'll put adults as 15 and up, that just are waiting for somebody to give them something super seriously dark and creepy and messed up at least once. Just show it to us, and then we'll tell you whether we like it or not. Superhero movies, there's lots of options now. So they're getting that diet. That diet is being filled. Somebody's not filling this other dietary need off in a corner, I think, and I'm completely biased. I think that hunger is bigger than the studios know right now. Because I keep seeing it. You know, like I said, 2 weeks ago, Nun opens up to 55 million. 55 million. And then in 2 weeks, the Halloween coming out, and I think it's tracking around 65 million. I mean, it's going to be the biggest, not the biggest, you know, horror movie opening in October. It's going to be, if it opens up to the number they're saying, Venom might break the record for October this weekend. And it will only last 2 weeks because Halloween may shatter that record in 2 weeks from now. So there is a hunger for creepy, scary stuff out there.
Yeah. And speaking of Halloween, I've seen some posters that you did for that floating around.
Oh, yeah. So I just saw one. They hadn't given me one yet. But, yeah, I did a poster. And one of the things we talked about was that the mask has got a lot more detail to it. So I went in there and did... you know, maybe more detail than I should have, but, you know, I put a bunch of lines in there just to show some of the texturing, that it's not that same sort of plastic head that you were used to. There's a little bit of texture and bounce to it. So.
And with McFarlane Toys right now, with Toys R Us going out of business earlier this year, even though they're talking about making a comeback now, how does that kind of impact you from a toy maker perspective?
I mean, obviously it was disappointing, and it's an impact. I don't think it was probably as big an impact as it probably was for, you know, big companies like Hasbro and Mattel that were selling, you know, tens of millions of dollars into those stores, right? So they lost a one-stop place where they could get a lot of revenue and a lot of capital. We just now have to take what we were selling to Toys R Us. And at times the last 5-6 years, they were at odds with what they were trying to do. So sometimes they were into our stuff and collectibles, and sometimes they weren't. And it was sort of a mixture depending on who was in charge. And so we've been able to fairly quickly sort of spread out what we lost at Toys R Us to, you know, other retailers. I mean, we live in a brave new world now. There's a thing called the internet, right? And there's lots of people that buy stuff on the internet and sell it direct. It can be just as geeky, if not obviously way more geeky than a store like Toys R Us, right?
And how's the construction aisle treating you all? Is it still doing probably the best business?
The construction aisle is an interesting one because I'm getting a sense that it's shopped by moms and dads in a younger generation. People who are hardcore action figure collectors or hardcore Star Wars or something like that don't necessarily then also go into the construction aisle and say, oh, and I need everything Star Wars in the construction aisle too, right? So it's a different dynamic. So I'm finding that probably as we go forward, we're going to continue to do construction that probably will still be in a 7 to 16 age and not probably do things like Aliens and Predator. I think that probably belongs in statues and action figures and other areas that aren't construction.
And what do you have on the horizon in the next year or so that you're excited about toy-wise?
Well, we got Fortnite, which is a giant, huge brand. I just came from a meeting from one of their headquarters with the head designer there on Tuesday. We cooked up a lot of crazy ideas because he's just a little 12-year-old boy in a man's body like I am. So we had a bit of a simpatico meeting that we're going to go, oh, my God, what if we did this and this and this and this and this? Oh, my God. And then he showed me a bunch of stuff that's coming out in the next year. So we've got that. The Destiny toys are doing good for us. Obviously, all of our sports toys and, you know, things like Stranger Things. We'll continue to do all the things that we're known for. But probably the thing I'm looking forward to in 2019 also is that we're going to start doing more direct toys to the consumer. So we're going to go back to our roots, and you're going to see more dragons and more monsters and more tortured souls and more twisted stuff. I mean, all that stuff that we've sort of built our reputation on, we're going to go back to it and start making those again. And if the stores that we used to sell them aren't in business anymore, which they aren't, Tower Records and KB Toys and Suncoast and all those places that used to support us, that since they don't exist, we'll just sell it straight to the consumer, right? It's the world we live in now, right? You can cut out the old system and just go direct to consumer.
And is there anything else that you want to mention in this interview?
By the time we sit down next year, issue 300 of Spawn will be out, the comic book. Issue 290 is just out. I tried a new thing with issue 290 where people are doing variant covers. So we did a variant black and white, but not just a cover. I made the whole book black and white. So it's a variant book. You can get a variant book. So one's colored and one's black and white. But as we get to issue 300, which will, you know, be right at the momentum, hopefully, as we're getting ready to release the movie. But the biggest sort of more exciting issue is the very next one, issue 301, because that sets a record. Right? Years ago, there was a book called Cerebus, the Aardvark, and it had 300 issues, and it was an independent comic book. And so Spawn, when it gets to 301, will now be a record setter. It will be the longest-running independent comic book in North America history. So I'm going, oh, and that will probably have come out just before New York Comic Con next year. So I'll be riding high on a couple of big events, issue 300, 301, and then hopefully I'll be able to drop another trailer, you know, at that point to get everybody sort of excited about what we're doing. I also signed, you know, developing some TV stuff, so we'll be making an announcement about some of that. And I think as early as next week, and we'll just keep pushing the boulder up the hill and just see where it all lands.
Hi, that was the Todd McFarlane interview, and we will restart this podcast right now. Welcome to the New York Comic Con edition of the Monkeys Fighting Robots podcast. My name is Matthew Sardo, the co-founder of Monkeys Fighting Robots, and I am joined today by a longtime Monkeys Fighting Robots contributor and think even longer person, Roger Adell. I know this guy from Chicago back in the day. He came to my last birthday in Chicago. I never met this guy forever, and we communicated online, and then he shows up at my last birthday in Chicago about 7 years ago. And you know what's funny is I can't remember what you were dressed up as. I think you were just, in my head, you're always heavy metal Roger.
Yeah, I had I still had long hair at the time, and my beard was a little bit longer, and I think I showed up in jeans and a black t-shirt, and I was Thor, Donald Blake.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that was like, I don't know, did the Thor movie come out at that point in time? I'm not even sure if the Thor movie came out at that point in time yet.
Yeah, it came out the previous summer, and there was the Donald Blake reference when he puts on that black t-shirt and there's a Donald Blake name tag on it.
Oh, yes. I remember trying to, like, because I went to San Diego Comic-Con that year, and they were giving out Captain America shirts or the Donald Blake shirt, and I was desperately trying to get that Donald Blake shirt, and it was a no-go. It was a no-go. And I ended up with a Captain America shirt that I've had forever. So that was good times. But I was thinking about that because Chris Evans just came out and said, you know, goodbye to fans and everything. And I went digging through my phone, and I went to one of the first screenings of Captain America: First Avenger, and Chris Evans was in my screening, and he gave a little speech before, and I was like, this is the most amazing thing ever. But we didn't really know what it meant at that point in time. We're like, yay, it's a Captain America movie. This is awesome. And we didn't really know what we were getting at that point in time. And but here we are now with Avengers Infinity War and the fourth film coming out. And it's just been an amazing 8-year run that he's had.
Yeah, what's your theory for how they wrap up his story?
I've been talking about this. One of my buddies that I go to press screenings with, we've just been talking about how Marvel works with their film franchises, and they kind of try to box out DC with their films, you know, because they didn't, you know, how DC didn't have Darkseid, and I'm trying to think of how the couple other films that they put out that have kind of blocked out characters that DC's wanted to use. But I really think Avengers 4 might be a flashpoint where they start the universe over without these people existing. And so then you get like a flashpoint universe where Captain America's alive, but like something's off kind of thing. So then like DC can't use Flashpoint. Cause it's like, wait a second, Marvel just did that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've heard Captain America wise is that maybe he just goes back in time and stays there.
Oh yeah. I definitely think that Chris Evans is going to take some time off. And one of the most amazing things about Captain America is Chris Evans could take 10, 15 years off and come back as, I really don't know how old he is, but he can come back as 55-year-old Cap and put on an awesome show too, because that is a storyline that could happen.
Yeah. Do you think they do Bucky Cap or Sam Cap after him?
Oh, man. That's a tough one, because I would like to see the guy who plays Bucky Barnes do a Luke Skywalker movie, because he looks exactly like Mark Hamill when he was a kid. You know, when Mark Hamill was in Star Wars. So I'm leaning towards Bucky becoming Luke Skywalker. So I guess I would want a Hawkeye Captain America.
Yeah, but are they turning Hawkeye into Ronin in Avengers 4, though?
Oh, not Hawkeye. I mean Falcon.
Falcon.
We were talking about DC, so I was like in a Hawkman mode, and so I was like, that's where my crossover comes in. So, yeah, because I wasn't, because you were at New York Comic Con this weekend, and that's why you actually called in. And I want to say, you were at one of the panels where they were talking about possibility of a DC Marvel crossover happening again.
Yeah, it was the Marvel Next Big Thing panel, and CB said that there's always communication between Marvel and DC about potential crossovers in the comic books, but that there's nothing in the plans right now. Because there had been a fan who came up during the question and answer part of that panel who brought up the Amalgam Universe from back in the 90s and wanted to know if they were going to do anything like that anytime soon.
I've been going back and looking at that stuff, and I've been decorating my like office / studio, and I've been going back and buying like 90s action figures. Like I got myself a Max figure, and I got myself a Grifter Wildcats figure, and then I was reviewing Venom, so I was flashing back. I was rereading old Spawn issues, and the 90s were just crazy. And I encourage everybody to take out a book from the 90s, your favorite book from the 90s, and open it up, look at it, and then lay your favorite book from like this year next to it, and just compare how far comic books have evolved. And it's just mind blowing when you set them right next to each other.
Oh yeah, I can guarantee you that anyone who goes back and rereads Maximum Carnage at this point isn't going to be as impressed as they were when they read it as a kid.
Oh man, you bring that up, and I remember, because this was like my heyday as a teenager. And so Terminator 2 comes out, and my mind is blown when that comes out. And it's just like one of the most impressive action movies that I've ever seen, sci-fi movies. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And so then I'm reading comic books, and you know, you got Venom doing his own thing and everything like that. And then like Carnage comes out, and then there's the origin of the first couple issues of Carnage. That story arc in Amazing Spider-Man. And I was like, wait a second, this is Terminator 2. Is nobody like gonna say like this is Terminator 2 at all? Like Carnage makes the same exact like weapons as the Terminator 2. I was like, come on, this is blatant ripoff from that.
Yeah, I mean, I love the original Carnage storyline, but Maximum Carnage is like probably second in the Spider-Man books as far as 90s overkill goes. I mean, first is obviously the Clone Saga.
Oh man, yeah, that's I'm trying to think of where the overkill is, because I did like because for me, I think like Amazing Spider-Man was coming out like in the 90s at like twice a week for a while, and so there was a whole bunch of like, this is the first of 6 issues, and so they do like a 3-month story arc, but it'd be like 6 issues. And so they had like Return of the Sinister Sticks, and let's step back a little bit further. For me, I felt like Spider-Man or Amazing Spider-Man was devolving because you went from Todd McFarlane to Eric Larson, and Eric Larson is an okay second artist after McFarlane. I mean, I like both of them, but like I was like, McFarlane is the best ever, and then you have like Eric Larson. And then you go to Mark Bagley, and I'm like, oh my God, this is, you just keep, you know, like when you like Xerox a copy, and then you copy that copy, and then you copy that copy again, like it keeps degrading. That's how I felt like Amazing Spider-Man was going for me as a kid.
Yeah, and I mean, I like Larson and Bagley a lot too, but I think that Todd definitely defined the look of Spider-Man for that whole generation.
And I'm trying to think, because there was like the Return of the Sinister Sticks, and there was some like weird like Moon Knight, Punisher, and I forgot who. I think like Nova and Darkhawk were in it, where they were like coming together to fight somebody. And then there was like,
yeah, Nova's in the Tri-Sentinel story arc.
Yeah,
around like 351, 352.
Yeah, and because they reintroduced Cardiac, which I really thought was kind of a cool character. Is he still alive, or did they kill him off?
He showed up in Superior Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah, he did.
He was doing a brain test on Otto Pete.
Yeah. I really like that character, because I was like, it was kind of like a, because I think with his electricity, he could fight off Venom or something like that. So they created a character that could like cancel out characters.
Yeah. But I think part of the biggest problem, just from a storytelling perspective, in some of those bigger story arcs, once you started having everything crossing over every month in Amazing, Spectacular, Web, and then the Adjectiveless Spider-Man, was that you had like too many people writing it, and it kind of felt disjointed on occasion from one book to the next.
Oh yeah, I totally remember that. Like, if you look at the way the books are set up, like you had Amazing, you had Web, and then you had Spectacular, and Charlie Allred, who does The Walking Dead. I love his Walking Dead, but as a kid, I couldn't stand his Spider-Man when he was working on Spider-Man. Like, I was like, who is this guy? And what is he doing? But now, like, he's one of my favorite artists working on The Walking Dead. So but I don't want him, you know, I didn't want him drawing Spider-Man back in the day, because I felt like Spectacular was like the worst of the artistry of the series at the time.
I mean, the adjectiveless Spider-Man book around the time that Maximum Carnage happened got kind of spotty. There's some covers from the Maximum Carnage story arc on that book where characters are standing on top of the buildings, but the proportions are off in a way that makes it look like the characters are as tall as the buildings.
Yeah, no, it was, and yeah, you had Spider-Man Unlimited, where I think it had like the Carnage wave coming over or something. It was weird.
Yeah,
it was such a bizarre time.
Because I mean, it's a 14-part story that could have been told in 6 or 7 parts.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't have made all the money. I mean, you know, there was back then. You know, you could actually buy Marvel stock. And when I had the comic book store, that was like the first thing I did was buy Marvel stock. I was like, yeah, I'm going to buy some Marvel stock because I'm, you know, I'm part of it now. And then it got bought by Disney like 2 years later. And I was like, oh, damn it. But I think I have some Disney stock now. I always tell my friends, because one of my friends are like, they do stocks and they're like, hey, Matt, is this movie good or not? And I was like, yeah, you should probably buy stock right before the movie comes out, because like after the opening week, it's going to like rock, you know, like right before Avengers 4 comes out, like you probably should buy Disney stock, because like once it makes $1 billion in the first week, the stock will probably go up like 10% and then you sell it and you're good, you know?
Yeah.
All right, so let's like quickly, I mean, you went and interviewed Todd McFarlane, and this is going to be the Todd McFarlane interview is going to be the highlight of this podcast. And I already edited it down, and you had some great questions, and you talk about Spawn and you talk about Venom, and there's some really good stuff going on there. And I always really like talking when you talk to Todd about business stuff like that. I consider the toy end where his business mind turns on. And that's always interesting to see how he thinks, because I look at Todd McFarlane as one of those people, like I look at him like as one of the genius founders, you know, like the guy who invented, you know, the iPhone. And I'm trying to think of the crazy CEOs of companies, because like he has a whole nother level of himself that he just pushes. It's so competitive. It's so crazy. And he wants to be the best. But when he goes into business mode, it is like super cutthroat, but it's also super inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, he pretty much started this whole like adult action figure line type of thing with Spawn and with a lot of those horror movie figures that he's done over the year, and the like the Metallica and Kiss figures and things like that.
And then he started it took me a little bit to understand what he was talking about, but like the building blocks and just the way he analyzes the system. And your last year's interview was the one that I was like, wow, this is genius. He's like, when your kid comes up to you and goes, hey dad, I want this. The fad is already passed. Like you've already missed it. Cause he went through the whole cycle of like kids and how they like find their approval of what's cool, what's not cool. And by the time a kid comes up to you and goes, hey, I need this, it's too late to be, you've missed the boat on trying to be edgy and stuff, because the kid has to like get approval from his friends. And then like, there's like usually like an outside group and other peers and all this stuff. It goes through this whole cycle of back and forth between, you know, the different kid groups. And then finally it's like, hey dad, I need some money 'cause I need to go buy this. And, that was a really just him. Him as a marketer, him as like analyzing the market is where like I get crazy business owner, like entrepreneur, like nerddom from him stuff.
Yeah, like I was surprised last year, just that the construction aisle was as profitable as it is for him. But I had never realized that the patent on Legos had opened up either. So it kind of makes all these things in that aisle more capable of intermingling.
And before we go into the interview, why don't you like set it up? Like, because you're a Todd McFarlane fan. Like, you're a super nerd. You even break the taboo. Like, I could never go in and try to get a book signed after interviewing Todd McFarlane. I might get a picture. I might get a picture, but I'll never be like, hey, Todd, can I get this? So set me up, you know, set me up on this year's interview with Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, so the funny thing about getting the book signed is that last year I was apprehensive about that because I asked him what time his signings were that weekend. And he was basically just like, oh, I'll sign it right now. You know, it's not something that I would normally ask someone to do right after an interview because it just kind of feels like one of those things where it's, for me, it feels like I'm jumping in line in front of other people who would want that, you know?
You know, what's funny is I've gone down to Miami and done some press junkets and... So they have you all set up, and so you walk in and you have your 4 minutes, and it's like counting down as soon as you walk into the thing. And sometimes you can squeeze out a photo, like a selfie. But then after that gets done, there's a round table with like mommy bloggers where like usually the talent comes in and it's, you know, 10, 15 minutes with the mommy bloggers. And the mommy bloggers have tons of stuff for them to sign. Like they have, it's funny because like, you hang out with the journalists and they're all professional and all this and blah, blah. But like journalism has evolved. So you have to like sell your brand. So getting a selfie with the people you just interviewed is part of doing business now because that's the evolution of journalism where you kind of have to sell yourself for it. But now like there's that next level, which I don't even call journalism, where it's like the mommy bloggers talking about, you know, like what they want to do and what they like and affiliate marketing and all this other stuff. But like after the round table, they've got like 10 things for people to sign. And I remember that with Jeremy Renner. Oh, he played Judge Dredd and I'm blanking on his name. He played Judge Dredd and he was in the Star Trek movie.
Carl Urban.
I was just like, cause I went in with like hard questions. I was like, hey Carl, you might never be able to do Star Trek again. Do you feel like they gave you the best Dr. McCoy ever? Like, you know, do you feel like your character is totally like hit its peak? And he's like, and he came at me and he's like, listen, I like the script. I like what we did. And, you know, I felt like I gave everything I could to the film. And like, it was kind of like a stare off. And then the mommy blogger comes in and goes, so how's it going about, you know, your wife and kid, blah, blah. Do you want to sign this book? And like, and I was like, oh, apparently we're in a different type of interview right now. It was crazy, but it was still a lot of fun. And it was, you know, you're always, it's weird, man. Like, cause I've done press junkets at like Super Bowls and I've done press junkets for films. And then I've done like conventions and it's so weird. The different levels of etiquette that comes with all this different stuff. Like, when you're covering like a football game, you're not allowed to cheer, or even like you're not allowed to cheer. Like, it's like, I'm trying to think. Baseball is probably the most silent when you're just watching it with the reporters, and then football is a little bit more talkative because, you know, football is more of a machismo sport, so there are people kind of talking about, ooh, that was a big hit, or ooh, that was a lot of it. And then hockey is very. It's probably very professional. Hockey is very professional, but there's still kind of like a nice camaraderie in there. And then I went to New York for the All-Star game for MLB, and I hung out with the Latin media, and it's a fucking party, like the whole time. And I was like, oh my God, I need to work in a Latin market because it's the most fun ever. So what do you, when you, because you did a couple of roundtable interviews at New York Comic Con. Like, what was, and I feel like pop culture journalism is still kind of evolving, and you know, the entry level to get in is kind of low, but you still have like top tier talent covering it. So what are your experiences with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I did the roundtable with the showrunner for Daredevil season 3, Eric Olson, and it was interesting how professional even like some of the smaller bloggers who were there were. There's such a variety of people who cover the pop culture conventions all the time that you get people who are from these glossier publications all the way down to people who are just like running their blogs.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And I mean, that's exactly, I mean, I think Todd talked about that last interview. He's like, hey, you know, with the internet, you can do almost anything. He's like, he's monkeys fighting robots. You know, they can just walk into a convention and interview Todd McFarlane. I mean, I was just cracking up when he said that too. I mean, like, all right, before we start the interview, what was the most awesome thing that you did, bought, saw at New York Comic Con?
All right, so I'll break this up into a few different things. There's a lot of cool cosplay that I saw this year. One of the more interesting ones that I saw was TMNT Raphael, who basically looked exactly like the movie costumes from the early 90s. And I don't know how much this guy spent on that costume. I imagine it was a small fortune, but it looked fantastic. And then there was a group of people doing symbiote cosplay, and it was some of the best symbiotes that I've seen. There was like a 7-foot
Yeah, I know you saw Venom, and they said symbiote, but you know it's symbiote, right? Like that's the common law. Symbiote, it's not symbiote.
Isn't symbiote?
Yes.
See, I thought the problem with Venom was that she said symbiote.
Oh, it could be. It could be. I don't know. I just remember when the first trailer came out and everybody was like, oh man, nobody could say anything like about that. They probably should pronounce it differently.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm from Kentucky originally. We don't really know how to talk there in general to begin with. But, yeah, so there was a Venom Wolverine, and I'm sure you've been to enough conventions at this point that you know how difficult it is for people to do either a Venom or a Wolverine cosplay alone that doesn't look cheesy. But this guy nailed Venom and Wolverine together, and that was fantastic.
Yeah, the cosplay is just insane how it's evolved. Because
yeah,
it's got to be their hobby. I mean, because it's one of those things where I was like, yeah, I really want to dress up for one of these conventions when I was younger. And then I'd like put a costume together, and I'm like, be the shittiest costume ever. I'm like, I felt like I put together some time. I tried to do stuff. I was like, but again, it's probably practice and skill and their hobby. And you got to, like anything, you have to practice and you have to spend time doing it. But like the
chances are that there's professional cosplayers now though.
Yes, there is. There are professional cosplayers. And my last MegaCon, I earned a lot of respect for some of the professional cosplayers because there was this one girl who she came up each day dressed completely different in a top-notch costume, full makeup, changing her whatever she wanted to be, whether she was like an elf to Wonder Woman, and then just kind of, I forgot what the other 3 days were. But she had a line of 50 people always, and she was always critiquing other people's cosplay. Like, oh my God, let me look at your outfit. And like, so compassionate, so complimentary. And I was like, this is why you have a line of 50 people, you know, always to talk to you, because like you're giving more back than you're taking from people. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. And like, I'm just surprised that some of these people aren't working in Hollywood because they're fantastic at putting these costumes together and doing makeup.
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, watching these people do these makeups, and I always kind of like get stuck on those videos where people are like, hey, this girl is going to change into Darth Maul. And I was like, I've got 30 seconds to burn. Why not? And then it's like, it ends up being a 10-minute video of her like redoing her whole entire face and making her look like, you know, something better than the films. And that's what, you know, we're seeing that more and more, where like as soon as they reveal a costume for a film or a TV show, there's always a better cosplayer out there. And they're like, why didn't you use this outfit?
Yeah.
Trying to think,
yeah, like, I mean, it's like all the people who have always said, for example, the Wolverine costume doesn't work in like a live action type of thing. But I've seen cosplay people who make that costume look like it could believably work.
Yeah. I'll never understand. You understand the ears once they take it off his head and you're like, oh, his hair kind of fits in there. But I've never understood the ears of the Wolverine mask. I mean, like, it just,
So I've always liked those best when they're a little bit lower and closer to the mask, because I've kind of always been the same with Batman's ears. I don't like them when they're super tall and pointy. I like them when they're a little bit shorter and closer to the mask.
Yeah. No, because I know, I'm trying to think, because it was before he opened up the store. So it was probably like 2005. I went to a Bears game and it was on Halloween, and I was like, oh, we should all dress up for the Bears game. I went to the least cosplay friendly event ever, dressed up as Batman. And people were like flicking my ears and people wanted to fight Batman. And I was like, listen, dude, like, I will fight you, but like, I'm also a Bears fan. Like, settle down. Like, but in my head, I was like, man, this is going to be great. Everybody's going to be dressed up because it's Halloween and it's the Bears game and it's a night game. And I was like, it's going to be amazing. And I got my costume together and we went and had like nice prime rib before the game. And then I went to the bathroom and I came out as Batman, and everybody in the restaurant like kind of just stopped. And they were just like, I don't know the hell. And that's when I realized, like, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing at this point in time. But I was like, I'll go with it. I'll just keep going. And it was hilarious. I mean, luckily the Bears won. But yeah, man, it was insane that I went into like the least now because you watch like Raider games and everybody's all dressed up, and you watch games now and people go crazy on how they dress up for football games. But apparently in 2005 I was ahead of the curve on that one.
Yeah. Back on the Comic-Con thing, so we've got the Frank Miller and Bendis panel that I went to, the Spider-Man panel, the Marvel Next Big Thing panel. You know, people can read all about that on the site. But one of the things that I didn't get a chance to write about that I went to was the Marvel Knights 20th anniversary panel. And there weren't a lot of big reveals during that panel, so much as it was just interesting listening to Joe Quesada and Jim Palmiotti and Chris Priest just kind of going back and forth about that whole process of creating all of that. And, you know, for example, how in Priest's Black Panther, the Dora Milaje were originally conceived not just as bodyguards to T'Challa, but also as kind of like brides for him, with one of them from each of Wakanda's tribe. And that was how the tribes of Wakanda were kind of kept at peace, because each of them had a kind of a stake in the throne that way. But nowadays, that doesn't work as well as it did, 20 years ago. Just from like a social standpoint and whatnot, you know?
Yeah, no, that's crazy. That's
and one of the other interesting things too is that after the panel, I got a chance to talk to Quesada for just a few seconds. And it was mainly just me walking up and telling him how much, and you're going to hate me for saying this, but how much I appreciated Brand New Day.
You son of a bitch.
But no, because basically what I told him was that, so everyone gets upset about the Mephisto deal, but in and I'm sure you've read Quesada's One Moment in Time that they did, I think, like 40 or 50 issues after the Mephisto deal, like well into Brand New Day, where it kind of closed out that sort of story. But basically, the way that the Mephisto deal played out, the Mephisto deal never happened.
You're going to have to explain that to me now.
All right, so basically in One Moment in Time, they reveal what MJ whispered in Mephisto's ear, because Peter didn't actually make the deal, if you remember. It was MJ who accepted Mephisto's deal.
Right.
And she whispers in his ear that if they accept that deal, Mephisto can never interfere in their lives again. And so in One Moment in Time, as they go back through all of these different key events in the relationship between Mary Jane and Peter, starting at the wedding, Mephisto doesn't directly interfere in any of these things breaking them apart. Basically, he takes the form of a bird that that lets the criminal out who hits Peter over the head with the brick just in happenstance and knocks Peter out, which is why Peter missed the wedding in the first place. And then he takes the form of a nurse in the hospital when Aunt May is shot, because basically Peter and MJ were still together after Peter accidentally blew the wedding. They just weren't married that whole time. But then they split up eventually. At that point in continuity, because when Peter makes the deal with Doctor Strange to erase his identity after he's able to revive May, because May flatlines at one point and he's successful in reviving her during the last panel of one of those issues, I think it's the third issue. But basically what splits up Mary Jane and Peter as a result of all of this is actually that when Peter made the deal with Doctor Strange to put that mind wipe in place regarding his identity with everyone, he kept MJ in the know, and MJ wanted to forget that he was Spider-Man, because that was her big hang up with the relationship, was that she couldn't live with Spider-Man because Peter was constantly in danger.
Yeah. I was like, I knew there'd be some anger coming up here at some point in time.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, this is all coming back to me now. And I was like, we started off with such a happy conversation, and then you had to go this way. My biggest thing with the Mephisto thing is if, you know, the way it went down, if they just had a thing where they were just never happy, you know, and where they could never be happy, because I'm trying to think, it's been a while. Because I read it, you know, a couple times back then, and I really haven't revisited. But I remember being like, okay, so what you're telling me is Mephisto is going to kind of erase things. But, like, I think he mentioned something about, like, you're always going to feel like you're missing out. You know, like, you're going to be dating, Peter will be dating a girl, but it'll never be good enough kind of thing. And, you know, I was hoping that, like, this love conquers all theme would kind of go through it, where, like, they didn't have to necessarily get back to, you know, they didn't have to get married again, but they would realize that they've always loved each other. And that could take 200 issues or 300 issues where, like, Peter would be going on dates and things would just be, like, messing up for whatever reason. And then, like, MJ going through her personal life and that stuff not working out. And then, like, it would give you little glimpses as a reader that, like, oh yeah, they're struggling. And then, you know, because they've done it with, like, Wolverine with no more mutants, like, one of them would figure out that there was a previous life where they were, like, together and stuff, you know? And I thought that there was a greater storytelling to be had than just kind of, like, wiping the slate clean. And then back to my...
That basically is what happened with both of them relationship-wise over the course of 200 or 300 issues.
Yeah. Because I guess I realized, I mean, I haven't really read Spider-Man in a little bit, but I was like, I saw that MJ and Spider-Man and Peter Parker are back together, and I was like, oh, okay, this is cute, you know. Spider-Man for me now is like, I'll read it in giant chunks of like 30 issues now, because I, you know, it's because I'm still so, because basically with one brand new day or one more day, that's where I end my run. I was like, I had a great run. I had tons of issues. It start to finish. This is my generation of Spider-Man. And then like whatever comes afterwards, that's your generation or somebody else's generation of Spider-Man, which is fine. And I've come to terms with it. And I'm like, this is my run right here. You know, I'll take the Clone Saga. I'll take that bullet, you know, I'll take that all in. But no, it's still tough for me. Cause like when I think about that, when they're like, oh man, we can't write good stories with Peter married. And I was like, well, you get better writers. Don't be fucking lazy. That's my biggest thing. I mean, just think about it like Todd McFarlane style. Like if a pitcher threw out 100 miles an hour and all the batters came back, oh man, we can't hit 100 miles an hour. Like all those players would be cut and they would get a batter. They would eventually get batters that could hit that pitch, you know, or they would keep trying. They wouldn't say like, hey, we need to change the rules to where the pitcher couldn't throw 100 miles an hour anymore so that we can play baseball. I mean, like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but I think there's a place that we can both agree here, though, is that at least with the Mephisto thing, they didn't go the route that they did the previous time that they split up Peter and MJ, where she was just on a plane that blew up.
Yeah.
And then they believed, like, he believed she was dead that whole time, but there was some kind of weird thing where they somehow brought her back.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is like, the other thing is, I was like, Aunt May could, you know, if you want to evolve the character and everything like that, kill Aunt May off and grieve and like move on. I mean, that would be another thing, you know, but
they gave her a pretty good death in 400 and then they had to bring her back.
Right. But if you think about how, oh, man, I can't believe we're going down this wormhole of Spider-Man. It always does it to me. But then, you know, like you now, like Aunt May lives and then she marries Jonah Jameson's brother, and then Peter and Jonah Jameson are brothers, or are they brothers?
They're basically stepbrothers.
They're stepbrothers now or something. Like, yeah, he marries Jonah's father, and so now like Peter and Jonah are stepbrothers, and I was like, who in the room was like, this is a good idea? Who?
I kind of like it. Jonah also knows now that Peter is Spider-Man, and he is constantly calling him anytime that something crazy is going on and telling him that he needs to go fix it.
Yeah, Jonah's like he's like the annoying neighbor now. He's just like, hey, my faucet's leaking. And he's like, I'm Spider-Man. I don't fix faucets. Yeah, you need to fix my faucet. You need to fix my faucet. I don't know, man.
I
mean,
I kind of like the Jonah dynamic, though, because like back in the day, they made him like this kind of grizzled, surly, older guy who seemed like he complained a lot and maybe didn't always have good intentions, but he also, they show time and time again, has his heart in the right place most of the time.
Oh, man. All right, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to say goodbye to you. And I'm going to start your Todd McFarlane interview so that people, because now we're 39 minutes into this podcast, and I keep teasing this Todd McFarlane interview. So we're actually gonna play the interview now. So Roger, are you on Twitter? How can people?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at rriddell3. It's RRIDDELL3. So you can follow me there. Sometimes I forget that Twitter exists, though, so there might be long spaces where you don't see anything from me on there, but I like to think that my tweets are generally fun when I am active on there.
I mean, that's the thing is, in my head, I have like two things that when I think of Roger Riddell, I think of Metal Roger and I think of Randy Macho Man Savage. Like that's if somebody's like, who's Roger Riddell? I was like, that's the metal guy who likes Randy Macho Man Savage. Like, that's the guy. And then, like, I mean, the comics is always, like, part of it. But it's, like, metal and Macho Man Savage. That's, like, where I go. Like, my go-to. So, but, Roger, thank you so much for going to New York Comic Con for Monkeys Fighting Robots. And I'm so jealous I didn't go to that Superman panel because, you know, I put that transcript together for the article that's on the website. It's so impressive. Like, Bendis can talk, that's fine, but like, listening to Frank Miller talk is really impressive. And then you also did the Spider-Man panel, which I really enjoyed because I caught up on a lot of things. And then just where Marvel is going right now was kind of cool. The next big thing, because there's some things going on with Thor that'll be interesting to see. And I think Jason Aaron has got some good stuff working on. But Roger, big thanks for going up there. It looked like you had a blast. I hope you did enjoy yourself.
Oh, yeah. I was, you know, more than happy to go up there and go to all these panels and talk to Todd McFarlane, who, as you know, has been my favorite comic artist of all time since I was a kid, like, and probably around the time that I started reading comics in like 1992, when I was reading some of the at that point it wasn't as distant, you know, back issues, but I grew up basically idolizing his art and trying to mimic it as a kid, and you know, now I get to go up there and talk to him. And then between all of this stuff, it's been close to like $400 on Spider-Man comics, so
you know, what's funny is I'm reading this right now, and you know what I think I'm going to do? Because, like, the interview is probably, I don't know, maybe 14 minutes. I'm probably going to introduce the interview at the beginning of the podcast so people can listen to that. And then, like, listen, if we this was the original plan, was to have a conversation, introduce the interview. But then we talked about Spider-Man for 42 minutes now. And here, basically what I'm going to do is we're changing it up live right now. I'm going to put the interview at the front of the podcast, and this is how we're going to close it out. So I'm Matt Sardo. You're Roger Riddell. This is Monkeys Fighting Robots. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, you know, go to our website, do all those fun things. And what I'm going to ask from you, Roger, is to close out the show with your best Macho Man quote ever.
Oh man, I need to think about this for a little bit. put me on the spot here. Monkeys fighting robots. Yeah.
Awesome, my friend.